Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane, narrated by Frank Muller. This book was first published in 1895. This recording is copyrighted 1981 by Recorded Books. Born in 1871, Stephen Crane was published at age 21, famous nationwide at 24, and dead of tuberculosis and reckless living at 28. He was born a minister's son and rebelled early in life against the religious discipline taught by his parents. He lived drawn to criminals and prostitutes, alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. He lived in poverty until 1894, when the Red Badge of Courage began serial publication in the Philadelphia Press. It brought him tremendous popularity, but his lifestyle wasn't changed by fame. 5 years later, he died, leaving behind two novels and some of the most celebrated short stories in the English language. And now, The Red Badge of Courage.
Chapter 1. The cold passed reluctantly from the earth, and the retiring fogs revealed an army stretched out on the hills, resting. As the landscape changed from brown to green, the army awakened and began to tremble with eagerness at the noise of rumors. It cast its eyes upon the roads, which were growing from long troughs of liquid mud to proper thoroughfares. A river, amber-tinted in the shadow of its banks, purled at the army's feet, and at night, when the stream had become of a sorrowful blackness, one could see across it the red, eye-like gleam of hostile campfires, set in the low brows of distant hills. Once a certain tall soldier developed virtues and went resolutely to wash his shirt. He came flying back from a brook, waving his garment, banner-like. He was swelled with a tale he had heard from a reliable friend, who had heard it from a truthful cavalryman, who had heard it from his trustworthy brother, one of the orderlies at division headquarters. He adopted the important air of a herald in red and gold. "We're going to move tomorrow, sure," he said pompously to a group in the company street. "We're going way up the river, cut across, and come around in behind him." To his attentive audience, he drew a loud and elaborate plan of a very brilliant campaign. When he had finished, the blue-clothed men scattered into small arguing groups between the rows of squat brown huts. A negro teamster who had been dancing upon a cracker box with the hilarious encouragement of 20 soldiers was deserted. He sat mournfully down. Smoke drifted lazily from a multitude of quaint chimneys. "It's a lie. That's all it is, a thundering lie," said another private loudly. His smooth face was flushed and his hands were thrust sulkily into his trousers pockets. He took the matter as an affront to him. "I don't believe the derned old army's ever going to move. We're set. Got ready to move 8 times in the last 2 weeks, and we ain't moved yet." The tall soldier felt called upon to defend the truth of a rumor he himself had introduced. He and the loud one came near to fighting over it. A corporal began to swear before the assemblage. He had just put a costly board floor in his house, he said. During the early spring, he had refrained from adding extensively to the comfort of his environment because he had felt that the army might start on the march at any moment. Of late, however, he had been impressed that they were in a sort of eternal camp. Many of the men engaged in a spirited debate. One outlined in a peculiarly lucid manner all the plans of the commanding general. He was opposed by men who advocated that there were other plans of campaign. They clamored at each other, numbers making futile bids for the popular attention. Meanwhile, the soldier who had fetched the rumor bustled about with much importance. He was continually assailed by questions. "What's up, Jim? The army's going to move." "Ah, what you talking about? How you know it is?" "Well, you can believe me or not." There was much food for thought in the manner in which he replied. He came near to convincing them by disdaining to produce proofs. They grew much excited over it. There was a youthful private who listened with eager ears to the words of the tall soldier and to the varied comments of his comrades. After receiving a fill of discussions concerning marches and attacks, he went to his hut and crawled through an intricate hole that served it as a door. He wished to be alone with some new thoughts that had lately come to him. He lay down on a wide bunk that stretched across the end of the room. In the other end, cracker boxes were made to serve as furniture. They were grouped about the fireplace. A picture from an illustrated weekly was put upon the log walls, and three rifles were paralleled on pegs. Equipments hung on handy projections, and some tin dishes lay upon a small pile of firewood. A folded tent was serving as a roof. The sunlight without, beating upon it, made it glow a light yellow shade. A small window shot an oblique square of whiter light upon the cluttered floor. The smoke from the fire at times neglected the clay chimney and wreathed into the room, and this flimsy chimney of clay and sticks made endless threats to set ablaze the whole establishment. The youth was in a little trance of astonishment. So they were at last going to fight. On the morrow, perhaps, there would be a battle, and he would be in it. For a time he was obliged to labor to make himself believe he could not accept with assurance an omen that he was about to mingle in one of those great affairs of the earth. He had, of course, dreamed of battles all his life, of vague and bloody conflicts that had thrilled him with their sweep and fire. In visions he had seen himself in many struggles. He had imagined peoples secure in the shadow of his eagle-eyed prowess. But awake, he had regarded battles as crimson blotches on the pages of the past. He had put them as things of the bygone, with his thought images of heavy crowns and high castles. There was a portion of the world's history which he had regarded as the time of wars, but it, he thought, had been long gone over the horizon, and had... From his home, his youthful eyes had looked upon the war in his own country with distrust. It must be some sort of a play affair. He had long despaired of witnessing a Greek-like struggle. Such would be no more, he had said. Men were better or more timid. Secular and religious education had effaced the throat-grappling instinct, or else firm finance held in check the passions. He had burned several times to enlist. Tales of great movements shook the land. They might not be distinctly Homeric, but there seemed to be much glory in them. He had read of marches, sieges, conflicts, and he had longed to see it all. His busy mind had drawn for him large pictures, extravagant in color, lurid with breathless deeds. But his mother had discouraged him. She had affected to look with some contempt upon the quality of his war ardor and patriotism. She could calmly seat herself, and with no apparent difficulty give him many hundreds of reasons why he was of vastly more importance on the farm than on the field of battle. She had had certain ways of expression that told him that her statements on the subject came from a deep conviction. Moreover, on her side was his belief that her ethical motive in the argument was impregnable. At last, however, he had made firm rebellion against this yellow light thrown upon the color of his ambitions. The newspapers, the gossip of the village, his own picturings, had aroused him to an uncheckable degree. They were in truth fighting finely down there. Almost every day the newspapers printed accounts of a decisive victory. One night, as he lay in bed, the winds had carried to him the clangoring of the church bell as some enthusiast jerked the rope frantically to tell the twisted news of a great battle. This voice of the people rejoicing in the night had made him shiver in a prolonged ecstasy of excitement. Later he had gone down to his mother's room and had spoken thus, "Ma, I'm going to enlist." "Henry, don't you be a fool," his mother had replied. She had then covered her face with the quilt. There was an end to the matter for that night. Nevertheless, the next morning he had gone to a town that was near his mother's farm and had enlisted in a company that was forming there. When he had returned home, his mother was milking the brindle cow. Four others stood waiting. "Ma, I've enlisted," he had said to her diffidently. There was a short silence. "Lord's will be done, Henry," she had finally replied, and then continued to milk the brindle cow. When he had stood in the doorway with his soldier's clothes on his back, and with the light of excitement and expectancy in his eyes, almost defeating the glow of regret for the home bonds, He had seen two tears leaving their trails on his mother. Still, she had disappointed him by saying nothing whatever about returning with his shield or on it. He had privately primed himself for a beautiful scene. He had prepared certain sentences which he thought could be used with touching effect. But her words destroyed his plans. She had doggedly peeled potatoes and addressed him as follows. "You watch out, Henry, and take good care of yourself in this here fighting business. You watch out and take good care of yourself. Now go a-thinking you can lick the whole rebel army at the start, 'cause you can't. You're just one little feller amongst a whole lot of others, and you got to keep quiet and do what they tell you. I know how you are, Henry. I've knit you 8 pair of socks, Henry, and I've put on all your best shirts because I want my boy to be just as warm and comfortable as anybody in the army. Whenever they get holes in them, I want you to send them right away back to me so as I can dern them. Also, be careful and choose your company. There's lots of bad men in the army, Henry. The army makes them wild. They like nothing better than the job of leading off a young feller like you, as ain't never been away from home much and has always had a mother and learning him to drink and swear. Keep clear of them folks, Henry. Don't want you ever to do anything, Henry, that you would be ashamed to let me know about. Just think as if I was a-watching you. If you keep that in your mind, Aldous, I guess you come out about right. You must also remember your father, too, child, and remember he never drunk a drop of liquor in his life and seldom swore a cross oath. I don't know what else to tell you, Henry, except then you must never do no shirking, child, on my account. If so be a time comes when you have to be kilt or do a mean thing, why, Henry, don't think of anything except what's right, because there's many a woman has to bear up against such things these times, and the Lord will take care of us all. Don't forget about socks and the shirts, child, and I put a cup of blackberry jam with your bundle, because I know you like it above all things. Goodbye, Henry. Watch out. Be a good boy. He had, of course, been impatient under the ordeal of this speech. It had not been quite what he expected, and he had borne it with an air of irritation. He departed feeling vague relief. Still, when he had looked back from the gate, he had seen his mother kneeling among the potato parings. Her brown face, upraised, was stained with tears, and her spare form was quivering. He bowed his head and went on, feeling suddenly ashamed of his... From his home he had gone to the seminary to bid adieu to many schoolmates. They had thronged about him with wonder and admiration. He had felt the gulf now between them and had swelled with calm pride. He and some of his fellows who had donned blue were quite overwhelmed with privileges for all of one afternoon, and it had been a very delicious thing. They had strutted. A certain light-haired girl had made vivacious fun at his martial spirit, but there was another and darker girl whom he had gazed at steadfastly, and he thought she grew demure and sad at sight of his blue and brass. As he had walked down the path between the rows of oaks, he had turned his head and detected her at a window watching his departure. As he perceived her, she had immediately begun to stare up through the high tree branches at the sky. He had seen a good deal of flurry and haste in her movement as she changed her attitude. He often thought of it. On the way to Washington, his spirit had soared. The regiment was fed and caressed at station after station until the youth had believed that he must be a hero. There was a lavish expenditure of bread and cold meats, coffee and pickles and cheese. As he basked in the smiles of the girls and was patted and complimented by the old men, he had felt growing within him the strength to do mighty deeds of arms. After complicated journeyings with many pauses, there had come months of monotonous life in a camp. He had had the belief that real war was a series of death struggles with small time in between for sleep and meals. But since his regiment had come to the field, the army had done little but sit still and try to keep warm. He was brought then gradually back to his old ideas. Greek-like struggles would be no more. Men were better or more timid. Secular and religious education had effaced the throat-grappling instinct, or else firm finance held in check the passions. He had grown to regard himself merely as part of a vast blue demonstration. His province was to look out as far as he could for his personal comfort. For recreation, he could twiddle his thumbs and speculate on the thoughts which must agitate the minds of the generals. Also, he was drilled and drilled and reviewed and drilled and drilled and reviewed. The only foes he had seen were some pickets along the river bank. They were a sun-tanned, philosophical lot who sometimes shot reflectively at the blue pickets. When reproached for this afterward, they usually expressed sorrow and swore by their gods that the guns had exploded without their permission. The youth on guard duty one night conversed across a stream with one of them. He was a slightly ragged man who spat skillfully between his shoes and possessed a great fund of bland and infantile assurance. The youth liked him personally. "Hank," the other had informed him, "you're a right dumb good feller." This sentiment, floating to him upon the still air, had made him temporarily... Various veterans had told him tales. Some talked of gray, bewhiskered hordes who were advancing with relentless curses and chewing tobacco with unspeakable valor. Tremendous bodies of fierce soldiery who were sweeping along like the Huns. Others spoke of tattered and eternally hungry men who fired despondent powders. "They'll charge through hell's fire and brimstone to get a holt on a haversack, and such stomachs ain't lastin' long," he was told. From the stories, the youth imagined the red live bones sticking out through slits in the faded uniforms. Still, he could not put a whole faith in veterans' tales, for recruits were their prey. They talked much of smoke, fire, and blood, but he could not tell how much might be lies. They persistently yelled "fresh fish" at him, and were in no wise to be trusted. However, he perceived now that it did not greatly matter what kind of soldiers he was going to fight, so long as they fought, which fact no one disputed. There was a more serious problem. He lay in his bunk pondering upon it. He tried to mathematically prove to himself that he would not run from a battle. Previously, he had never felt obliged to wrestle too seriously with this question. In his life, he had taken certain things for granted, never challenging his belief in ultimate success, and bothering little about means and roads. But here he was confronted with a thing of moment. It had suddenly appeared to him that perhaps in a battle he might run. He was forced to admit that, as far as war was concerned, he knew nothing of himself. A sufficient time before, he would have allowed the problem to kick its heels at the outer portals of his mind. But now he felt compelled to give serious attention to it. A little panic fear grew in his mind. As his imagination went forward to a fight, he saw hideous possibilities. He contemplated the lurking menaces of the future, and failed in an effort to see himself standing stoutly in the midst of them. He recalled his visions of broken-bladed glory, but in the shadow of the impending tumult, he suspected them to be impossible pictures. He sprang from the bunk and began to pace nervously to and fro. "Good Lord, what's the matter with me?" he said aloud. He felt that in this crisis his laws of life were useless. Whatever he had learned of himself was here of no avail. He was an unknown quantity. He saw that he would again be obliged to experiment, as he had in early youth. He must accumulate information of himself. And meanwhile he resolved to remain close upon his guard, lest those qualities of which he knew nothing should everlastingly disgrace him. "Good Lord," he repeated in dismay. After a time the tall soldier slid dexterously through the hall. A loud private followed. They were wrangling. "That's all right," said the tall soldier as he entered. He waved his hand expressively. "You can believe me or not, just as you like. All you got to do is sit down and wait as quiet as you can, and pretty soon you'll find out I was right." His comrade grunted stubbornly. For a moment he seemed to be searching for a formidable reply. Finally he said, "Well, you don't know everything in the world, do you?"
"Didn't say I knew everything in the world," retorted the other sharply.
He began to stow various articles. The youth, pausing in his nervous walk,
looked down at the busy figure. "Going to be a battle, sure, is there, Jim?" he asked. "Of course there is," replied the tall soldier. "Of course there is. You just wait till tomorrow, and you see one of the biggest battles ever was. You just wait." "Thunder," said the youth. "Oh, you'll see fighting this time, my boy. Well, it'll be regular out-and-out fighting," added the tall soldier, with the air of a man who was about to exhibit a battle for the benefit of his friends. "Huh," said the loud one from a corner. "Well," remarked the youth, "like as not this story'll turn out just like them others did." "Not much it won't," replied the tall soldier, exasperated. "Not much it won't. Didn't the cavalry all start this morning?" He glared about him. No one denied his statement. "The cavalry started this morning," he continued. "They say there ain't hardly any cavalry left in camp. They're going to Richmond or someplace while we fight all the Johnnies. It's some dodge like that. The regiment's got orders, too. A feller what seen them go to headquarters told me a little while ago, and they're raising blazes all over camp. Anybody can see that."
"Shucks," said the loud one. The youth remained silent for a time. At last he spoke to the tall soldier. "Jim?"
"What?"
"How do you think the regiment'll do?"
"Oh, they'll fight all right, I guess, after they once get into it," said the other with cold judgment.
He made a fine use of the third person.
"There's been heaps of fun poked at 'em 'cause they're new, of course, and all that, but they'll fight all right, I guess."
"Think any of the boys'll run?" persisted the youth.
"Oh, well, there may be a few of 'em run, but there's them kind in every regiment, especially when the first goes under fire," said the other in a tolerant way. "Of course, it might happen that the whole kit and caboodle might start and run if some big fighting came first off. Then again, they might stay and fight like fun. But you can't bet on nothing. Of course, they ain't never been under fire yet, and it ain't likely they'll lick the whole rebel army all to once the first time. But I think they'll fight better than some, if worse than others. That's the way I figure. They call a regiment fresh fish and everything, but the boys come a good stock, and most of them will fight like sin after they once get shooting," he added, with a mighty emphasis on the last four words. "Oh, you think you know," began the loud soldier with scorn.
The other turned savagely upon him. They had a rapid altercation in which they fastened upon each other various strange epithets. The youth at last interrupted them.
"Did you ever think you might run yourself, Jim?" he asked.
On concluding the sentence, he laughed as if he had meant to aim a joke. The loud soldier also giggled. The tall private waved his hand.
"Well," he said profoundly, "I thought it might get too hot for Jim Conklin in some of them scrimmages, and if a whole lot of boys started and run, why, I suppose I'd start and run. And if I once started to run, I'd run like the devil, or no mistake. But if everybody was a-standing and a-fighting, why, I'd stand and fight. Jiminy, I would. I'd bet on it."
"Huh!" said the loud one. The youth of this tale felt gratitude for these words of his comrade. He had feared that all of the untried men possessed a great and correct confidence. He now was, in a measure, reassured. Chapter 2. The next morning, the youth discovered that his tall comrade had been the fast-flying messenger of a mistake. There was much scoffing at the latter by those who had yesterday been firm adherents of his views, and there was even a little sneering by men who had never believed the rumor. The tall one fought with a man from Chatfield Corners and beat him severely. The youth felt, however, that his problem was in no wise lifted from him. There was, on the contrary, an irritating prolongation. The tale had created in him a great concern for himself. Now, with the newborn question in his mind, he was compelled to sink back into his old place as part of a blue demonstration. For days he made ceaseless calculations, but they were all wondrously unsatisfactory. He found that he could establish nothing. He finally concluded that the only way to prove himself was to go into the blaze and then figuratively to watch his legs to discover their merits and faults. He reluctantly admitted that he could not sit still and with a mental slate and pencil derive an answer. To gain it, he must have blaze, blood, and danger, even as a chemist requires this, that, and the other. So he fretted for an opportunity. Meanwhile, he continually tried to measure himself by his comrades. The tall soldier, for one, gave him some assurance. This man's serene unconcern dealt him a measure of confidence, for he had known him since childhood, and from his intimate knowledge he did not see how he could be capable of anything that was beyond him, the youth. Still, he thought that his comrade might be mistaken about himself, or, on the other hand, he might be a man heretofore doomed to peace and obscurity, but in reality made to shine in war. The youth would have liked to have discovered another who suspected himself. A sympathetic comparison of mental notes would have been a joy to him. He occasionally tried to fathom a comrade with seductive sentences. He looked about to find men in the proper mood. All attempts failed to bring forth any statement which looked in any way like a confession to those doubts which he privately acknowledged in himself. He was afraid to make an open declaration of his concern because he dreaded to place some unscrupulous confidant upon the high plane of the unconfessed from which elevation he could be derided. In regard to his companions, his mind wavered between two opinions, according to his mood. Sometimes he inclined to believing them all heroes. In fact, he usually admitted in secret the superior development of the higher qualities in others. He could conceive of men going very insignificantly about the world, bearing a load of courage unseen. And although he had known many of his comrades through boyhood, he began to fear that his judgment of them had been blind. Then, in other moments, he flouted these theories and assured himself that his fellows were all privately wondering and quaking. His emotions made him feel strange in the presence of men who talked excitedly of a prospective battle, as of a drama they were about to witness, with nothing but eagerness and curiosity apparent in their faces. It was often that he did not pass such thoughts without severe condemnation of himself. He dinned reproaches at times. He was convicted by himself of many shameful crimes against the gods of traditions. In his great anxiety, his heart was continually clamoring at what he considered the intolerable slowness of the generals. They seemed content to perch tranquilly on the riverbank and leave him bowed down by the weight of a great problem. He wanted it settled forthwith. He could not long bear such a load, he said. Sometimes his anger at the commanders reached an acute stage, and he grumbled about the camp like a veteran. One morning, however, he found himself in the ranks of his prepared regiment. The men were whispering speculations and recounting the old rumors. In the gloom before the break of the day, their uniforms glowed a deep purple hue. From across the river, the red eyes were still peering. In the eastern sky there was a yellow patch like a rug laid for the feet of the coming sun, and against it, black and pattern-like, loomed the gigantic figure of the colonel on a gigantic horse. From off in the darkness came the trampling of feet. The youth could occasionally see dark shadows that moved like monsters. The regiment stood at rest for what seemed a long time. The youth grew impatient. It was unendurable the way these affairs were managed. He wondered how long they were to be kept waiting. As he looked all about him and pondered upon the mystic gloom, he began to believe that at any moment the ominous distance might be a flare, and the rolling crashes of an engagement come to his ears. Staring once at the red eyes across the river, he conceived them to be growing larger, as the orbs of a row of dragons advancing. He turned toward the colonel and saw him lift his gigantic arm and calmly stroke his mustache. At last he heard from along the road at the foot of the hill the clatter of a horse's galloping hoofs. It must be the coming of orders. He bent forward, scarce breathing. The exciting clickety-click, as it grew louder and louder, seemed to be beating upon his soul. Presently a horseman with jangling equipment drew rein before the colonel of the regiment. The two held a short, sharp-worded conversation. The men in the foremost ranks craned their necks. As the horseman wheeled his animal and galloped away, he turned to shout over his shoulder, "Don't forget that box of cigars!" The colonel mumbled in reply. The youth wondered what a box of cigars had to do with war. A moment later, the regiment went swinging off into the darkness. It was now like one of those moving monsters wending with many feet. The air was heavy and cold with dew. A mass of wet grass marched upon rustled like silk. There was an occasional flash and glimmer of steel from the backs of all these huge crawling reptiles. From the road came creakings and rumblings as some surly... The men stumbled along, still muttering speculations. There was a subdued debate. Once a man fell down, and as he reached for his rifle, a comrade, unseeing, trod upon his hand. He of the injured finger swore bitterly and aloud. A low, tittering laugh went among his fellows. Presently they passed into a roadway and marched forward with easy strides. A dark regiment moved before them, and from behind also came the tinkle of equipments on the bodies of marching men. The rushing yellow of the developing day went on behind their backs. When the sun rays at last struck full and mellowingly upon the earth, the youth saw that the landscape was streaked with two long, thin, black columns, which disappeared on the brow of a hill in front and rearward vanished in a wood. They were like two serpents crawling from the cavern of the night. The river was not in view. The tall soldier burst into praises of what he thought to be his powers of perception. Some of the tall one's companions cried with emphasis that they, too, had evolved the same thing, and they congratulated themselves upon it. But there were others who said that the tall one's plan was not the true one at all. They persisted with other theories. There was a vigorous discussion. The youth took no part in them. As he walked along in careless line, he was engaged with his own eternal debate. He could not hinder himself from dwelling upon it. He was despondent and sullen, and threw shifting glances about him. He looked ahead, often expecting to hear from the advance the rattle of firing. But the long serpents crawled slowly from hill to hill without bluster of smoke. A dun-colored cloud of dust floated away to the right. The sky overhead was of a fairy blue. The youth studied the faces of his companions. Ever on the watch to detect kindred emotions, he suffered disappointment. Some ardor of the air which was causing the veteran commands to move with glee, almost with song, had infected the new regiment. The men began to speak of victory as of a thing they knew. Also, the tall soldier received his vindication. They were certainly going to come around in behind the enemy. They expressed commiseration for that part of the army which had been left upon the river bank, felicitating themselves upon being a part of a blasting host. The youth, considering himself as separated from the others, was saddened by the blithe and merry speeches that went from rank to rank. The company wags all made their best endeavors. The regiment tramped to the tune of laughter. The blatant soldier often convulsed whole files by his biting sarcasms aimed at the tall one. And it was not long before all the men seemed to forget their mission. Whole brigades grinned in unison. A rather fat soldier attempted to pilfer a horse from a dooryard. He planned to load his knapsack upon it. He was escaping with his prize when a young girl rushed from the house and grabbed the animal's mane. There followed a wrangle. The young girl with pink cheeks and shining eyes stood like a dauntless statue. The observant regiment, standing at rest in the roadway, whooped at once and entered whole-souled upon the side of the maiden. The men became so engrossed in this affair that they entirely ceased to remember their own large war. They jeered the piratical private and called attention to various defects in his personal appearance, and they were wildly enthusiastic in support of the young girl. To her, from some distance, came bold advice. "Hit him with a stick!" There were crows and catcalls showered upon him when he retreated without the horse. The regiment rejoiced at his downfall. Loud and vociferous congratulations were showered upon the maiden, who stood panting and regarding the troops with defiance. At nightfall, the column broke into regimental pieces, and the fragments went into the fields to camp. Tents sprang up like strange plants. Campfires like red, peculiar blossoms dotted the night. The youth kept from intercourse with his companions as much as circumstances would allow him. In the evening he wandered a few paces into the gloom. From this little distance the many fires with the black forms of men passing to and fro before the crimson rays made weird and satanic effects. He lay down in the grass, The blades pressed tenderly against his cheek. The moon had been lighted and was hung in a treetop. The liquid stillness of the night enveloping him made him feel vast pity for himself. There was a caress in the soft winds, and the whole mood of the darkness, he thought, was one of sympathy for himself in his distress. He wished without reserve that he was at home again, making the endless rounds from the house to the barn, from the barn to the fields, from the fields to the barn, from the barn to the house. He remembered he had often cursed the brindle cow and her mates, and had sometimes flung milking stools. But from his present point of view, there was a halo of happiness about each of their heads, and he would have sacrificed all the brass buttons on the continent to have been enabled to return to them. He told himself that he was not formed for a soldier, and he mused seriously upon the radical differences between himself and those men who were dodging imp-like around the fires. As he mused thus, he heard the rustle of grass, and upon turning his head discovered the loud soldier. He called out, "Oh, Wilson!" The latter approached and looked down. "Why, hello, Henry, is it you? What are you doing here?" "Oh, thinking," said the youth. The other sat down and carefully lighted his pipe. "You're getting blue, my boy. You're looking thunder and peaked. What the dickens is wrong with you?" "Oh, nothing," said the youth. The loud soldier launched then into the subject of the anticipated fight. "Oh, wow, we've got 'em now." As he spoke, his boyish face was wreathed in a gleeful smile, and his voice had an exultant ring. "We've got 'em now. At last, by the eternal thunders, we'll lick 'em good." "If the truth was known," he added more soberly, "they've licked us about every clip up to now. But this time... "I thought you was objecting to this march a little while ago," said the youth coldly. "Oh, wasn't that," explained the other. "I don't mind marching if there's going to be some fighting at the end of it. What I hate is this getting moved here and moved there with no good coming of it, as far as I can see, except in sore feet and damn short rations." "Well, Jim Conklin says we'll get plenty of fighting this time." "He's right for once, I guess, though I can't see how it come. This time we're in for a big battle, and we got the best end of it, certain sure. T-Rod, how we will thump 'em!" He arose and began to pace to and fro, excitedly. The thrill of his enthusiasm made him walk with an elastic step. He was sprightly, vigorous, fiery in his belief in success. He looked into the future with clear, proud eye, and he swore with the air of an old soldier. The youth watched him for a moment in silence. When he finally spoke, his voice was as bitter as dregs. "Oh, you're going to do great things, I suppose." The loud soldier blew a thoughtful cloud of smoke from his pipe. "Oh, I don't know," he remarked with dignity. "I don't know. I suppose I'll do as well as the rest. I'm going to try like thunder." He evidently complimented himself upon the modesty of this statement. "How do you know you won't run when the time comes?" asked the youth. "Run?" said the loud one. "Run! Of course not," he laughed. "Well," continued the youth, "lots of good enough men have thought that they was going to do great things before the fight, but when the time come, they skedaddled." "No, that's all true, I suppose," replied the other, "but I'm not going to skedaddle. A man that bets on my running will lose his money, that's all." He nodded confidently. "Oh, shucks," said the youth. "You ain't the bravest man in the world, are you?" "No, I ain't," exclaimed the loud soldier indignantly. "And I didn't say I was the bravest man in the world, neither. I said I was going to do my share of fighting. That's what I said, and I am, too. Who are you, anyway? You talk as if you thought you was Napoleon Bonaparte." He glared at the youth for a moment, and then strode away. The youth called in a savage voice after his comrade, "We needn't get mad about it." But the other continued on his way and made no reply. He felt alone in space when his injured comrade had disappeared. His failure to discover any mite of resemblance in their viewpoints made him more miserable than before. No one seemed to be wrestling with such a terrific personal problem. He was a mental outcast. He went slowly to his tent, and stretched himself on a blanket by the side of the snoring, tall soldier. In the darkness, he saw visions of a thousand-tongued fear that would babble at his back and cause him to flee while others were going coolly about their country's business. He admitted that he would not be able to cope with this monster. He felt that every nerve in his body would be an ear to hear the voices, while other men would remain stolid and deaf. And as he sweated with the pain of these thoughts, he could hear low, serene sentences. "I'll bid 5. Make it 6. 7. 7 goes." He stared at the red, shivering reflection of a fire on the white wall of his tent until, exhausted and ill from the monotony of his suffering, he fell asleep. Chapter 3. When another night came, the columns, changed to purple streaks, filed across 2 pontoon bridges. A glaring fire wine-tinted the waters of the river. Its rays, shining upon the moving masses of troops, brought forth here and there sudden gleams of silver or gold. Upon the other shore, a dark and mysterious range of hills was curved against the sky. The insect voices of the night sang solemnly. After this crossing, the youth assured himself that at any moment they might be suddenly and fearfully assaulted from the caves of the lowering woods. He kept his eyes watchfully upon the darkness. But his regiment went unmolested to a camping place, and its soldiers slept the brave sleep of wearied men. In the morning they were routed out with early energy and hustled along a narrow road that led deep into the forest. It was during this rapid march that the regiment lost many of the marks of a new command. The men had begun to count the miles upon their fingers, and they grew tired. "Sore feet and damned short rations, that's all," said the loud soldier. There were perspiration and grumblings. After a time they began to shed their knapsacks. Some tossed them unconcernedly down. Others hid them carefully, asserting their plans to return for them at some convenient time. Men extricated themselves from thick shirts. Presently, few carried anything but their necessary clothing, blankets, haversacks, canteens, and arms and ammunition. "You can now eat and shoot," said the tall soldier to the youth. "That's all you want to do." There was sudden change from the ponderous infantry of theory to the light and speedy infantry of practice. The regiment, relieved of a burden, received new impetus, but there was much loss of valuable knapsacks and, on the whole, very good shirts. But the regiment was not yet veteran-like in appearance. Veteran regiments in the army were likely to be very small aggregations of men. Once, when the command had first come to the field, some perambulating veterans, noting the length of their column, had accosted them thus, "Hey, fellers, what brigade is that?" And when the men had replied that they formed a regiment and not a brigade, the older soldiers had laughed and said, "Oh, God!" Also, there was too great a similarity in the hats. The hats of a regiment should properly represent the history of headgear for a period of years, and, moreover, there were no letters of faded gold speaking from the colors. They were new and beautiful, and the color-bearer habitually oiled the pole. Presently the army again sat down to think. The odor of the peaceful pines was in the men's nostrils, the sound of monotonous axe blows rang through the forest, and the insects nodding upon their perches crooned like old women. The youth returned to his theory of a... One gray dawn, however, he was kicked in the leg by the tall soldier, and then, before he was entirely awake, he found himself running down a wood road in the midst of men who were panting from the first effects of speed. His canteen banged rhythmically upon his thigh, and his haversack bobbed softly. His musket bounced a trifle from his shoulder at each stride and made his cap feel uncertain upon his head. He could hear the men whisper jerky sentences. "Say, what's all this about? What the thunder we skedaddling this way for? Billy, keep off my feet! You run like a cow!" And the loud soldier's shrill voice could be heard. "What the devil ain't set you here for?" The youth thought the damp fog of early morning moved from the rush of a great body of troops. From the distance came a sudden spatter of firing. He was bewildered. As he ran with his comrades, he strenuously tried to think, but all he knew was that if he fell down, those coming behind would tread upon him. All his faculties seemed to be needed to guide him over and past obstructions. He felt carried along by a mob. The sun spread, disclosing rays, and one by one, regiments burst into view, like armed men just born of the earth. The youth perceived that the time had come. He was about to be measured. For a moment he felt in the face of his great trial like a babe, and the flesh over his heart seemed very thin. He seized time to look about him calculatingly. But he instantly saw that it would be impossible for him to escape from the regiment. It enclosed him, and there were iron laws of tradition and law on four sides. He was in a moving box. As he perceived this fact, it occurred to him that he had never wished to come to the war. He had not enlisted of his free will. He had been dragged by the merciless government, and now they were taking him out to be slaughtered. The regiment slid down a bank and wallowed across a little stream. The mournful current moved slowly on, and from the water, shaded black, some white bubble eyes looked at the men. As they climbed the hill on the farther side, artillery began to boom. Here the youth forgot many things as he felt a sudden impulse of curiosity. He scrambled up the bank with a speed that could not be exceeded by a bloodthirsty man. He expected a battle scene. There were some little fields girted and squeezed by a forest. Spread over the grass and in among the tree trunks, he could see knots and waving lines of skirmishers who were running hither and thither and firing at the landscape. A dark battle line lay upon a sun-struck clearing that gleamed orange color. A flag fluttered. Other regiments floundered up the bank. The brigade was formed in line of battle, and after a pause started slowly through the woods in the rear of the receding skirmishers, who were continually melting into the scene to appear again farther on. They were always busy as bees, deeply absorbed in their little combats. The youth tried to observe everything. He did not use care to avoid trees and branches, and his forgotten feet were constantly knocking against stones or getting entangled in briars. He was aware that these battalions, with their commotions, were woven red and startling into the gentle fabric of softened greens and browns. It looked to be a wrong place for a battlefield. The skirmishers in advance fascinated him. Their shots into thickets and at distant and prominent trees spoke to him of tragedies, hidden. Once the line encountered the body of a dead soldier. He lay upon his back, staring at the sky. He was dressed in an awkward suit of yellowish-brown. The youth could see that the soles of his shoes had been worn to the thinness of writing paper, and from a great rent in one the dead foot projected piteously. And it was as if fate had betrayed this soldier. In death had exposed to his enemies that poverty which in life he had perhaps concealed from his friends. The ranks opened covertly to avoid the corpse, the invulnerable dead man forced a way for himself. The youth looked keenly at the ashen face. The wind raised the tawny beard. It moved as if a hand were stroking it. He vaguely desired to walk around and around the body and stare. The impulse of the living to try to read in dead eyes the answer to the question. During the march, the ardor which the youth had acquired when out of view of the field rapidly faded to nothing. His curiosity was quite easily satisfied. If an intense scene had caught him with its wild swing as he came to the top of the bank, he might have gone roaring on. This advance upon nature was too calm. He had opportunity to reflect. He had time in which to wonder about himself and to attempt to probe his sensations. Absurd ideas took hold upon him. He thought that he did not relish the landscape. It threatened him. A coldness swept over his back, and it is true that his trousers felt to him that they were no fit for his legs at all. A house, standing placidly in distant fields, had to him an ominous look. The shadows of the woods were formidable. He was certain that in this vista there lurked fierce-eyed hosts. The swift thought came to him that the generals did not know what they were about. It was all a trap. Suddenly those close forests would bristle with rifle barrels. Iron-like brigades would appear in the rear. They were all going to be sacrificed. The generals were stupids. The enemy would presently swallow the whole command. He glared about him, expecting to see the stealthy approach of his death. He thought that he must break from the ranks and harangue his comrades. They must not all be killed like pigs, and he was sure it would come to pass unless they were informed of these dangers. The generals were idiots to send them marching into a regular pen. There was but one pair of eye in the corps. He would step forth and make a speech. Shrill and passionate words came to his lips. The line, broken into moving fragments by the ground, went calmly on through fields and woods. The youth looked at the men nearest him and saw, for the most part, expressions of deep interest, as if they were investigating something that had fascinated them. One or two stepped with over-valiant airs, as if they were already plunged into war. Others walked as upon thin ice. The greater part of the untested men appeared quiet and absorbed. They were going to look at war, the red animal. War, the blood-swollen god. And they were deeply engrossed in this march. As he looked, the youth gripped his outcry at his throat. He saw that even if the men were tottering with fear, they would laugh at his warning. They would jeer him, and if practicable, pelt him with missiles. Admitting that he might be wrong, a frenzied declamation of the kind. He assumed then the demeanor of one who knows that he is doomed alone to unwritten responsibilities. He lagged, with tragic glances at the sky. He was surprised presently by the young lieutenant of his company, who began heartily to beat him with a sword, calling out in a loud and insolent voice, "Come, young man, get up in the ranks there. No skulking'll do here." He mended his pace with suitable haste, and he hated the lieutenant, who had no appreciation of fine minds. He was a mere brute. After a time, the brigade was halted in the cathedral light of a forest. The busy skirmishers were still popping. Through the aisles of the wood could be seen the floating smoke from their rifles. Sometimes it went up in little balls, white and compact. During this halt, many men in the regiment began erecting tiny hills in front of them. They used stones, sticks, earth, and anything they thought might turn a bullet. Some built comparatively large ones, while others seemed content with little ones. This procedure caused a discussion among the men. Some wished to fight like duelists, believing it to be correct to stand erect and be from their feet to their foreheads a mark. They said they scorned the devices of the cautious. But the others scoffed in reply and pointed to the veterans on the flanks who were digging at the ground like terriers. In a short time there was quite a barricade along the regimental fronts. Directly, however, they were ordered to withdraw from that place. This astounded the youth. He forgot his stewing over the advance movement. "Well, then, what did they march us out here for?" he demanded of the tall soldier. The latter, with calm faith, began a heavy explanation. Although he had been compelled to leave a little protection of stones and dirt, to which he had devoted much care and skill. When the regiment was aligned in another position, each man's regard for his safety caused another line of small entrenchments. They ate their noon meal behind a third one. They were moved from this one also. They were marched from place to place with apparent aimlessness. The youth had been taught that a man became another thing in battle. He saw his salvation in such a change. Hence this waiting was an ordeal to him. He was in a fever of impatience. He considered that there was denoted a lack of purpose on the part of the generals. He began to complain to the tall soldier. "I can't stand this much longer," he cried. "I don't see what good it does to make us wear out our legs for nothing." He wished to return to camp, knowing that this affair was a blue demonstration, or else to go into a battle and discover that he had been a fool in his doubts, and was, in truth, a man of traditional courage. The strain of present circumstances he felt to be intolerable. The philosophical tall soldier measured a sandwich of cracker and pork, and swallowed it in a nonchalant manner. "Oh, I suppose we must go reconnoitering around the country just to keep 'em from getting too close or to develop 'em or something." "Huh!" cried the loud soldier. "Well," cried the youth, still fidgeting, "I'd rather do anything most than go tramping around the country all day doing no good to nobody and just tiring ourselves out." "So would I," said the loud soldier. "It ain't right. I tell you, if anybody was any sense was a running this army, it—" "Oh, shut up!" roared the tall private. "You little fool, you little damn cuss. You ain't had that there coat and them pants on for 6 months. You talk as if—" "Well, I want to do some fighting anyway," interrupted the other. "I didn't come here to walk. I could have walked to home, round and round the barn, if I just wanted to walk." The tall one, red-faced, swallowed another sandwich as if taking. But gradually, as he chewed, his face became again quiet and contented. He could not rage in fierce argument in the presence of such sandwiches. During his meals, he always wore an air of blissful contemplation of the food he had swallowed. His spirit seemed then to be communing with the viands. He accepted new environment and circumstance with great coolness, eating from his haversack at every opportunity. On the march, he went along with the stride of a hunter, objecting to neither gait nor distance, and he had not raised his voice when he had been ordered away from three little protective piles of earth and stone, each of which had been an engineering feat worthy of being made sacred to the name of his grandmother. In the afternoon, the regiment went out over the same ground it had taken in the morning. The landscape then ceased to threaten the youth. He had been close to it and become familiar with it. When, however, they began to pass into a new region, his old fears of stupidity and incompetence reassailed him. But this time he doggedly let them babble. He was occupied with his problem, and in his desperation he concluded that the stupidity did not greatly matter. Once he thought he had concluded that it would be better to get killed directly and end his troubles. Regarding death, thus, out of the corner of his eye, he conceived it to be nothing but rest, and he was filled with a momentary astonishment that he should have made an extraordinary commotion over the mere matter of getting killed. He would die. He would go to some place where he would be understood. It was useless to expect appreciation of his profound and fine senses from such men as the lieutenant. He must look to the grave for comprehension. The skirmish fire increased to a long, clattering sound. With it was mingled faraway cheering. A battery spoke. Directly the youth would see the skirmishers running. They were pursued by the sound of musketry fire. After a time, the hot, dangerous flashes of the rifles were visible. Smoke clouds went slowly and insolently across the fields like observant phantoms. The din became crescendo, like the roar of an oncoming train. A brigade ahead of them and on the right went into action with a rending roar. It was as if it had exploded, and thereafter it lay stretched in the distance behind a long gray wall that one was obliged to look twice at to make sure that it was smoke. The youth, forgetting his neat plan of getting killed, gazed spellbound. His eyes grew wide and busy with the action of the scene. His mouth was a little ways open. Of a sudden he felt a heavy and sad hand laid upon his shoulder. Awakening from his trance of observation, he turned and beheld the loud soldier. "It's my first and last battle, old boy," said the latter, with intense gloom. He was quite pale, and his girlish lip was trembling. "Eh?" murmured the youth in great astonishment. "It's my first and last battle, old boy," continued the loud soldier. "Something tells me—"
"What?"
"I'm a gone coon this first time, and I want you to take these things here to my folks." He ended in a quavering sob of pity for himself. He handed the youth a little packet done up in a yellow envelope.
"Why, what the devil—" began the youth again.
But the other gave him a glance as from the depths of a tomb, and raised his limp hand in a prophetic manner. Chapter 4. The brigade was halted in the fringe of a grove. The men crouched among the trees and pointed their restless guns out at the field. They tried to look beyond the smoke. Out of this haze they could see running men. Some shouted information and gestured as they hurried. The men of the new regiment watched and listened eagerly while their tongues ran on in gossip of the battle. They mouthed rumors that had flown like birds out of the unknown.
"They say Perry's been driven in with a big loss." "Yes. Carrot went to hospital. He said he was sick. That smart lieutenant is commanding G Company. The boys say they won't be under Carrot no more if they all have to desert. Dallas knew he was—" "Hannis's battery is took."
"That ain't either. I saw Hannis's battery off the left not more than 15 minutes ago."
"Well?"
"The general. He says he's going to take the whole command of the 304th when we go into action. And then he says we'll do such fighting as never another one regiment done."
"They say we're catching it over on the left. They say the enemy drove our line into a devil of a swamp and took Hennis's battery."
"No such thing. Hennis's battery is long here about a minute ago."
"That young Hasbrook, he makes a good officer. He ain't afraid of nothing."
"I met one 148th the Maine boys, and he says his brigade fit the whole rebel army for 4 hours over the Turnpike Road and killed about 5,000 of them. Says one more is such fighting as that, and the war will be over. Bill wasn't scared neither. No, sir, wasn't that. Bill ain't getting scared easy. He was just mad is what he was. And that feller trod on his handy up and said that if he was willing to give his hand to his country, that he'd be damned if he's going to have every dumb bushwhacker in the country walking round on it. So he went to hospital, disregardless of the fight. 3 fingers is crunched. That darn doctor wanted to amputate him, and Bill, he raised a hell of a row, I hear. He's a funny feller. The din in front swelled to a tremendous chorus. The youth and his fellows were frozen to silence. They could see a flag that tossed in the smoke angrily. Near it were the blurred and agitated forms of troops. There came a turbulent stream of men across the fields. A battery, changing position at a frantic gallop, scattered the stragglers right and left. A shell, screaming like a storm banshee, went over the huddled heads of the reserves. It landed in the grove, and exploding, redly flung the brown earth. There was a little shower of pine needles. Bullets began to whistle among the branches and nip at the trees. Twigs and leaves came sailing down. It was as if 1,000 axes, wee and invisible, were being wielded. Many of the men were constantly dodging and ducking their heads. The lieutenant of the youth's company was shot in the hand. He began to swear so wondrously that a nervous laugh went along the regimental line. The officer's profanity sounded conventional. It relieved the tightened senses of the new men. It was as if he had hit his fingers with a tack hammer at home. He held the wounded member carefully away from his side so that the blood would not drip upon his trousers. The captain of the company, tucking his sword under his arm, produced a handkerchief and began to bind with it the lieutenant's wound. And they disputed as to how the binding should be done. The battle flag in the distance jerked about madly. It seemed to be struggling to free itself from an agony. The billowing smoke was filled with horizontal flashes. Men running swiftly emerged from it. They grew in numbers until it was seen that the whole command was fleeing. The flag suddenly sank down as if dying, its motion as it Wild yells came from behind the walls of smoke. A sketch in gray and red dissolved into a mob-like body of men who galloped like wild horses. The veteran regiments on the right and left of the 304th immediately began to jeer. With the passionate song of the bullets and the banshee shrieks of shells were mingled loud catcalls and bits of facetious advice concerning places of safety. But the new regiment was breathless with horror. "God! Saunders got crushed!" whispered the man at the youth's elbow. They shrank back and crouched as if compelled to await a flood. The youth shot a swift glance among the blue ranks of the regiment. The profiles were motionless, carven, and afterward he remembered that the color sergeant was standing with his legs apart, as if he expected to be pushed to the ground. The following throng went whirling around the flank. Here and there were officers carried along on the stream like exasperated chips. They were striking about them with their swords and with their left fists, punching every head they could reach. They cursed like highwaymen. A mounted officer displayed the furious anger of a spoiled child. He raged with his head, his arms, and his legs. Another, the commander of the brigade, was galloping about, bawling. His hat was gone and his clothes were awry. He resembled a man who had come from bed to go to a fire. The hoofs of his horse often threatened the heads of the running men, but they scampered with singular fortune. In this rush they were apparently all deaf and blind. They heeded not the largest and longest of the oaths that were thrown at them from all directions. Frequently over this tumult could be heard the grim jokes of the critical veterans, but the retreating men apparently were not even conscious of the presence of an audience. The battle reflection that shone for an instant in the faces on the mad current made the youth feel that forceful hands from heaven would not have been able to have held him in place if he could have got intelligent control of his legs. There was an appalling imprint upon these faces. The struggle in the smoke had pictured an exaggeration of itself on the bleached cheeks and in the eyes, wild with one desire. The sight of this stampede exerted a flood-like force that seemed able to drag sticks and stones and men from the ground. They of the reserves had to hold on. They grew pale and firm and red and quaking. The youth achieved one little thought in the midst of this chaos. The composite monster which had caused the other troops to flee had not then appeared.
He resolved to get a view of it, and then he thought he might very likely run better than the best of them.
This ends Disc 1.